Welcome to the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. Cue momentous riff. So this week's guest, Shauna Kenny, wrote a killer blog post over at Brevity called Never Call Yourself a Writer and Other Rules for Writing. It's brilliant. Go read it. It's in the show notes. Everything. Everything you've come to expect. Okay, so I read it, then went to her website, found her email, and 2 weeks later, here she is. Send thank you notes to the internet. She's written and edited a few books, but we don't talk about that because I'm hoping to have her on again when her new book comes out this summer. It's a book she's co-written with her husband, so stay tuned to that. But we do dive into her punk rock roots and the fanzine she founded as a teenager. You know, the usual good stuff you've come to expect from CNFHQ. Do me a solid. Subscribe to the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, a.k.a. hashtag CNF, wherever you get your podcasts, namely the Apple Podcast app or Google Play Music, and give it a rating. Also, subscribe to my monthly newsletter where I send out my reading list just once a month. You listen to all these writers talk, so naturally you like reading, right? Okay, I'm tired of talking. Here's Shauna Kenny. Enjoy.
A small town in southern Maryland. Called St. Mary's County. It's about an hour and a half south of D.C. It's very rural. All that's there is a Navy base, which is what brought my parents there, and Amish people. So it's a weird mix. And my closest neighbors were miles away. So there was really no punk scene or literary scene for me to get into. I spent a lot of time alone. I spent a lot of time creating with friends. And then when I got to be old enough to go to DC, I was traveling with friends as a teenager to DC for punk shows. And I was really influenced and captivated by that culture. And I started doing a fanzine when I was 16 in high school called No Scene Zine, because I lived in the middle of nowhere and there was no scene. And that, I think, became a way for a shy kid to have an excuse to talk to people. My fanzine was all about skateboarding and music and pop culture. And I would create it for hours and for months on end with friends, cutting and pasting. And then we'd Xerox a whole bunch of them and go up to DC and sell them or hand them out at shows and trade them with other zinesters and trade them with other zinesters through the back pages of Maximum Rock and Roll. And so I was, you know, becoming pen pals with people all over the country, and the punk scene sort of became a you know, this whole pre-internet web of people for me to connect with. So doing zines was really my beginnings of being a writer, although I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's a very like entrepreneurial thing that you did then to kind of just like, oh, here's this thing. There's this. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I think I witnessed what was going on in the DC punk scene. That it was very DIY. They were starting, kids were starting their own record labels. Ian MacKaye was 18 when he started Discord Records. They put out their own records, folded the covers, did their own artwork, and distributed them themselves and put on their own shows. And I saw all this happening nearby, and I think that really empowered me. It showed me and a whole other generation of kids how to do it. You know, that you didn't have to wait for the powers that be to sanction your work or, you know, buy it and promote it in a certain way. That this is something that you could do yourself.
Yeah, like it's totally just bypassing the gatekeepers in a lot of ways and doing the thing that you feel strongly about.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's stayed with me. I mean, I think that's an ethic that has carried me through life.
It's funny you said you were, a shy kid, and the zine was a way for you to sort of break out of that shell. And I think a lot of journalists and reporters, some of them are kind of reticent by nature, but the vocation is a way to break out of that. And You know, what about that did you embrace? Like, was it something like you noticed you were shy and you're like, this is a good way for me to break through? Or was it just, I don't know, like how did you process that?
Yeah, it wasn't a conscious choice at the time. I just love to create. I've always been a creative kid. I made things out of clay. I drew and painted. And I think when I was a teenager, I played bass and I played trumpet, but I realized I wasn't a good enough musician or maybe a confident enough musician to ever be in a band. So my way of contributing to the scene was by making a zine. That's something I could do and something that I felt confident about. But looking back, now I see that it also enabled me to talk to people. It gave me an excuse to talk to people, which the natural progression was I got into journalism in high school and in college. I wrote for my school paper, and never really knowing that I wanted to be a writer. Like, that was just something I did for fun on the side. I didn't know that people could be writers. I don't know. I come from a very working class family.
Right.
And I'm a first generation college student. So, you know, the best that my parents could hope for was that my sister and I would graduate from high school. It was hard to really think beyond that. College wasn't talked about in my home. My dad was a maintenance man for the Department of Defense, and my mom was a secretary. So, you know, people in our family were not artists.
Right. So what was it, do you think, about books and words that you were so attracted to at a young age that eventually, like, springboarded you to writing for your high school paper, and then so from there, you know, it blossomed into something much more?
Yeah. Well, like any reader, of course, I loved that they could take me away. Like, stories could transport me out of my small town and out of my sheltered experience to other eras, other countries, other dimensions. But then when I started to read things like, you know, Judy Blume or A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, and all of the S.E. Hinton books, I felt like, wow, writers can say so much on the page that maybe we don't talk about in real life. And that's what it's done for me. I mean, I'm much better on the page than I am verbally. And I feel like writing has enabled me to talk about some of those things that I would never have been able to talk about in person, whether it's poverty or awkward teenage years or sexuality, feminism, you just concepts that I find difficult to talk about.
Yeah.
It's easier for me to struggle with on the page.
Yeah. It's one, what's so great about, you know, reading your work is that you do have such a distinctive voice on the page. Like, you can, it's just like, so like it crackles with, you know, your style, which is just so wonderful to read. And I wonder, like, how did you come to that, to the voice that you have today? Like, what were some of your early software that you were able to update over the years to come to this crystallized version of who you are on the page?
Maybe just repetition. You know, I was always journaling, keeping a diary as a kid. And then the zine really helped me to develop that voice because I had this outlet with no rules, no editor. And I could just kind of be free on the page. I'm the one in charge. I'm the one putting this out. So it was really no holds barred. And I think that gave me the freedom to sort of figure out who I was and how I sounded on the page. And then journalism too. Journalism taught me some rules that I didn't know about, right? You know, the zine was anarchy, and then journalism gave me this framework to work within. But I think that all of that helped me to develop my voice.
Right. And doing that early on, you gave yourself permission to do that kind of work, and eventually at some point or another you need, or maybe you didn't, but a lot of times you need some degree of validation. Who was in your corner at that time that kind of gave you, say, you know what, Shauna, like, keep going.
I guess, you know, it was my punk community. Mm. Because I didn't know any other writers. I didn't know anyone in academia. I wrote Ian MacKaye a fan letter. My mom cut an article out of the Washington Post when I was 16. That they'd done an interview with Ian MacKaye. He was starting his band Embrace after Minor Threat, pre-Fugazi. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned in the interview that he answers all of his fan mail. So, of course, I got to work writing him a letter. And I'm 16 and I do a zine in Southern Maryland and no one cool lives here. And I'd like to interview mm-hmm. you. And he wrote me back. Like a month later, I got a letter back from him. And he encouraged me to keep going. And he also encouraged me to introduce myself next time I saw him at a show and said that he'd like to meet me. And I think just that accessibility and that little bit of encouragement was all I needed enough to make me dangerous. So I did end up interviewing him and writing back to him. We went back and forth a few times and then met him at a show. And I think just seeing what he was able to do on his own without the permission of others, and then just those little few words of encouragement were enough to keep me going during those years.
Right, right. And it's so important to whatever it is we do to kind of like find your people and find your tribe. Yeah. And it seems like from an early point, like you were able to sort of weave your way into some sort of tribe, and that was those punk years, and especially, and then you know you probably got into your writerly tribes and such. But so, what was it about the punk life and the punk tribe that drew you in?
It was so opposite of everything I'd been exposed to before. You know, I lived in this small conservative Navy-based town. Grew up in a strict Catholic military family, and you know, just hearing bands like the Dead Kennedys and Circle Jerks and Sex Pistols just be so anti-establishment was mind-blowing and exciting for me. I was like, wow, there's a whole other world out there that I need to find.
Yeah,
it speaks to me. I never really felt like I fit in here. But maybe I fit in somewhere else, or maybe there are other people like me somewhere. I was like on an alien planet or something.
And when you were able to get the big interview with Ian, like what were some of the things that you asked him?
Oh God, I don't remember. I'm sure they were stupid questions. but oddly enough, so we wrote back and forth a couple times, and then years later, I interviewed him as a journalist for some magazines, and I interviewed him for that 930 Club book project. So I know him now, and I had to reach out to him for the 930 Club book project a couple years ago, and we had an interview set up, and I called him at the assigned time. And he was like, hang on a second, I want to read you something. And he started reading a letter. It's like, dear Ian, I know you must get tons of fan mail, but I just had to reach out to tell you how much I admire you and how much your work has inspired me. It was my 16-year-old words he was reading back to me.
That's amazing.
Feel my whole face turn red, and I like covered my ears. I was like, shut up, why do you have this, be quiet. And he continued to read the letter, and he said, oh, I have a friend who's been helping me archive some of my things, and I came across three of your letters and I scanned them for you and I'm going to send them to you. And he was like, don't be embarrassed, you were a really sweet kid, you still are. And it was so weird. And then when he sent me the PDFs of my letters, you know, bubbly handwriting, misspelled vegetarianism, and happy faces. It was just a, you know, a portal to my teen self that was actually quite a gift. It was really cool.
What was that like to not only that he had hung on to that letter, but that he recognized who you were? And yeah, what was that like when you reflect on that? Like, what does that mean that he was able to do that for you and read that back to you?
That was really special. I mean, I think he hangs on to everything. He's a hoarder, so I'm not special.
But he recognized you nonetheless.
slash punk documentarian, but really nice that he sent those to me and kind of gave me that window into my 16-year-old self, you know, because I don't have my diaries from back then. I have my zines, but just to see where I was at the time. And it's also funny because essentially I'm kind of the same person. You know, I was talking about vegetarianism and straight edge and all of these things that were swirling around in the air at the time. And I'm still vegetarian. I'm still straight edge. Just a little more worldly now, I guess. But
yeah,
the essence of me was there.
Yeah. And it's funny that you... It's like your writing has such an edge to it, and that to hear you say like you're so straight edge, I wonder like it's. I think anybody who's read your work would be like, oh, there's like a there is a rawness and a, I really like a punkness to a lot of your work, and to hear you say you're straight edge seems to cut against that. So it's like, do you try to lead like a more not refined but a straight edge type life so you can be crazy on the page?
I don't know. You know, I always wanted to be Hunter S. Thompson without the drugs.
Right. Like,
that was my ideal when I was in college because I loved his writing and his adventures and the freedom that evoked it in reading it. But I've never really been interested in the whole like drug culture.
Yeah. Aspect.
So maybe that's my way of, you know, embracing both sides of me.
So you mentioned Hunter Thompson again. Yeah, he's got his own brand of that gonzo journalism.
Yeah.
And so who were some other influential, let's say it can be fiction, but also let's, you know, nonfiction writers, like who were some of those, like they gave you like a key and they're like, oh, you can do that. They unlock something. Like, I didn't know that was possible. Who were some of those other writers?
You know, I love Jack Kerouac. I loved all the Beats. A lot of male writers early on, you know, I wasn't aware of a lot of women writers until later. And then I got into Annie Dillard and Joan Didion and people like that, bell hooks. But I loved the freedom that the Beats showed on the page to me. I was like, wow, you can just, you know, you can just be rambly and do the stream of conscious stuff and write about your really personal experiences without censor, you know? I think something about that empowered me. But then I also love stories about poor and marginalized people. I love A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. That's one of the few books that I've returned to read again and again. Mary Carr, Michelle T. I just like people who write about being on the fringes.
Do you consider yourself more of a freelancer or you?
Yeah, I'm definitely freelance. I've written for the LA Weekly, New York Times. Narratively, I've gotten the opportunity to do some long form stuff for them, which is really fun. I'd like to do more of that. But yeah, I'm definitely freelance, self-employed, independent contractor.
Right. Yeah, I know what that's like. What's great about it and what's painfully frustrating about it, too.
Exactly. Yeah, it has its pros and cons. But, you know, I worked in the corporate world for a few years after college, and I wasn't cut out for that either. I can't do the office culture thing, the 8-to-5 thing, the long commute thing in LA.
Yeah. With your time in the corporate world there, do you remember a particular moment where you're like, this is it, No, I can't do this anymore. I need to get back to my zine roots.
I don't know if it was a moment or just like a gradual, you know, building of hatred.
A slow erosion.
But yeah, that's when I applied to grad school, actually. Okay. When I applied to grad school, my book had already been out 5 or 6 years. My first book, my memoir, I'd done a book tour, I sold foreign rights, had been optioned for film a couple times, and I was freelance writing, and I just really didn't know where to go from there. I was invited in as a guest teacher, a visiting author a couple times to UCLA, and the teacher who invited me in said, why aren't you teaching? You know, he thought that I would be good at it, and I said, I don't know how to do that. Mm-hmm. So I applied to their program to teach, and they were like, oh, it's nice that you have a book out, but it'd be better if you had an MFA. So then I really started, and I'd never really thought about the MFA. So I started looking into that. I had a friend who teaches women's studies here at Cal State Long Beach. She has a PhD, and she really held my hand through the whole, I found the whole application process to be really intimidating. I didn't want to take the GRE. I wanted teaching experience, so I needed a TA-ship. I needed some financial help. I just was bewildered by the whole thing, and she really walked me through that process, and I applied to programs that were basically based on a writing sample and in places where I thought I could live and where I would get the teaching experience. And I ultimately ended up going to UNCW, which is in North Carolina, which meant quitting my corporate job and my husband and I picking up and moving 3,000 miles back to the East Coast, and living in a small town in North Carolina.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was a huge shift for us. A huge change, a huge cut in pay, and a huge learning experience for me because I had no idea. You know, I was a little older than the rest of the students that I was in school with. So it's 10 years since my undergrad degree. I'd published a book. I was married. I don't drink. I had a very lively literary community here in LA. I hosted literary events, so I'd made tons of friends with writers of all genres here, and felt very supported and connected to a community. So moving to this small town to really just focus on writing for 3 years was really weird.
How important was it for you to, it's like this kind of theme of these tribes you're able to build. Like, how important was it for you to forge those little tribes wherever you were? Like, you know, you had the punk scene and the zine, and then in LA you forged these little, you know, these literary events and groups and so forth. So like, what inside you is like, it seems like you're really driven to do that as a service to other people, but also probably as a service to yourself in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's my lifeline. I mean, who are we without each other? I don't know. I just always been that way. And then I've also been disconnected from my family since a young age. I was disowned when I was 18. And I mean, there's been a lot of healing that's happened since then. And I'm back in touch with them. But I've had to sort of forge my own family out in the world. And I think punk rock is part of that. I think my literary scene is part of that. And then, yeah, when we moved to North Carolina, grad school was really beneficial in a lot of ways, but I didn't necessarily feel like academia was my people. So my husband and I opened a bookstore. Don't open a bookstore during grad school, first of all. but we opened an independent bookstore called Rebel Books. Where
awesome.
We reached out to the community, had open mics, poetry nights, cooking demonstrations. We sold all kinds of anarchist and LGBTQ literature and stuff that was hard to find otherwise in that town. And it was short-lived. It was only open for a year, but I think through that, we really found our people.
Mm. What did you learn most from that experience?
Oh, I learned that I love to read books. I love to write books, but I don't really give a shit about selling books. I'm a terrible business person, basically.
Uh-huh.
But the beauty of that whole experience was that we found our community. It drew like-minded people to us. You know, we had critical mass bike rides. We had vegan cookbook authors come to do cookbook demonstrations. We had banned books week. Produced in conjunction with the ACLU in the state. And, you know, it helped us to meet our tribe again.
And like, you've got to, you know, you say your work has been like New York Times, you know, Playboy, Vice. How are you able to break into such, so like iconic iconic publications. Like, what's your submission process like? And then how do you deal with the inevitable rejection? Because, you know, sometimes for you can pitch a place like New York Times 20, 30, 40 times and not get in. Yeah. So, you know, how did you manifest that and process that whole process?
Yeah, I guess just getting into journalism at such a young age, I got used to the idea of rejection, you know, so it really has to roll off your back. And I always have a lot of projects going on at once. So it's not like I pitch an outlet and sit there waiting, hopefully, for the next few weeks. I have editing projects, I'm teaching, I may be working on another story, I may be, you know, coaching someone through writing their memoirs. So I've always had a lot of different things going on and been able to shift gears pretty quickly. But yeah, just never giving up. I'm spacious.
What's the most, that's a wide swath of the writing genre, you know, some coaching and editing and the writing. And so what is the, where do you get the most satisfaction among all those?
I like it all because I feel like they all activate different parts of my brain. But coaching is something new in my life. It just kind of evolved out of teaching so many classes. I've had students come to me afterward and want to work with me one-on-one. And I never really knew that that was a thing until a couple years ago. And I live in LA, the land of life coaches. So it's something that I've made fun of for a long time.
Yeah.
And now here I am, a coach. No, I'm in no way a life coach. Don't do what I did. But yeah, that just sort of naturally evolved. And I love working one-on-one with people and holding their hands through big projects. I want to be that person for them that I didn't have or that I wished I'd had.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of satisfaction in that for me. And I love teaching. I love the whole energy of the classroom and bouncing ideas off of one another and spontaneity and just really watching writers develop. It gives me a lot of joy.
Do you have, or did you have like an influential teacher or mentor that you're able to kind of like model yourself after?
All of my grad school teachers brought something different to the table, and looking back, I learned so much from every one of them. You know, I don't know that that they specifically mentored me individually, but just watching the way they taught and how they presented the material and met me where I was. You know, I wasn't a particularly educated grad student. I, like I said, I'd been out of undergrad for 10 years. I had a degree in film and communications. Most of my peers were 23-year-olds who just finished degrees in literature. I didn't even know how to talk about writing. You know, I just felt like I didn't have the book. I knew I liked to read, but I wasn't able to explain, you know, why I liked or didn't like something. I just felt like I didn't even have that vocabulary. So I'm really actually grateful that my professors were gentle and patient with me. I learned a lot just from watching.
Yeah, because that's real intimidating, like coming into a place where people have this, sometimes a pretentious literacy about them where they can talk about Chaucer and all the big capital English lit writers. And then you're coming in, like, you clearly have, you know, you had written the book, had some journalistic experience, so you had some actual like working writer experience, so you came at it from a different way. So like, not knowing how to talk about or not having the vocabulary, like, what was that like for you, and how did you start to learn that language yourself, that so you could be like, you know, as fluent in that language as they were?
Yeah, it was really scary. It was intimidating. And my first workshops, I never spoke out. Mm-hmm. I never talked in workshop. I didn't know how to have a literary discussion. I think over time, you know, I watched and learned and listened. And at first I felt like, wow, everyone knows so much more than I do. And, you know, I have nothing to contribute to this conversation. And I think really just like returning to writers' that I loved initially, like Michelle T and Dorothy Allison and Mary Carr, I think going back to read them reminded me that maybe I do have something to bring to the table. It's not going to be the same as this person next to me. And sometimes that person across the room is just really trying to impress the teacher. Right. And it might not be like, you know, real valid analysis anyway. So it took a little while for me to get more confident in my uniqueness and trust what I had to bring to the table might be interesting too.
Right. And it's, into like what Roy Peter Clark calls like X-ray reading, you know, is it really getting into the bones of a text. How do you balance trying to read enough volume, you know, enough books per year with that degree of, blanking on the word, but that degree of like in-depth reading, you know, like there's a balance because you can't just fly through it. Eventually, you kind of have to, take your time with those sentences. So how do you balance the speed to read, but also to slow down so you can get underneath it all?
Yeah. Well, I feel really fortunate because I teach memoir. And I feel like that's given me an excuse to buy a lot of memoirs and read a lot of memoirs now. Otherwise, I feel like I don't have a ton of pleasure reading time. Not that reading is without pleasure, but a lot of times I'm buying books and reading them with an eye toward what could I use this for or what's in here that I could share with students. You know, these are great examples of telescoping, you know, make a note to use in class. These are great examples of compression. This is a great example of, a well fleshed out scene, whatever it may be. So I am reading memoir, especially with a more critical eye than I ever did before grad school. And now that I'm a teacher, there's a greater purpose for it. You know?
Who are some writers and memoirists that just knock you back in your chair?
Like I said, Michelle T, Mary Carr, Dorothy Allison. I just taught a class last night and I brought these four memoirs in to show.
So we've got Cheryl Strayed, Wild.
Yeah, Cheryl Strayed, Wild, Autobiography of a Face, Lucy Greeley, fellow UNCW alum, Nothing Left to Burn by Jay Varner. A friend of mine, Jillian Lauren, wrote this book, Everything You Ever Wanted. I use my friend's book, A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints by Ditto Montiel, a bunch in memoir classes. It's a really sort of experimental structure and poetic voice. Yeah, so I'm always changing it up, but I inhale memoirs.
And now getting to the piece that I read from you that made me want to reach out to you was this great little blog post, which probably was maybe 300 words long. In the neighborhood. It's called You Never Call Yourself a Writer and Other Rules for Writing. And where did that – it's such a great seesaw piece, and we'll put it in the show notes and everything so everyone can read it. It's such a fun piece to read, and I wonder where did that piece come from?
Okay. Well, part of it came from being a bewildered grad student and all the advice that you get. And actually, one of the lines there, you know, is directly ripped from my life. Before I went off to grad school, someone told me, don't go to grad school. You'll lose your voice. Mm-hmm. You have such a great voice and you're going to get that MFA voice. I didn't even know what that was at the time. And looking back, you know, like, being a first generation college student who's like scrambled my way into college, that was such a stunning thing to hear. You know, it was kind of scary. So I used that in the piece. And now that I teach memoir and work with a lot of writers, you know, I just hear all kinds of crazy advice out there. And most of it is contradictory. And I've had students come to me and ask me, am I too old? Is it too late? One teacher told me to do this, or my friend said I should do that. And I just realize how overwhelming all of this information is. There's really no one right way to do your art. And, I started that piece maybe 6 months ago. And I just wrote a couple lines, just wrote a couple of contradictory ideas that I'd been hearing that had been floating around. And then I went back to it every couple months. I'd think about it and just add a couple things and add a couple things. So it wasn't written all in one sitting. It was written in teeny tiny pieces over a period of time, because I'd be like, oh yeah, that's something that people always say too.
Oh, that's great.
And I'd add to that. So, and you know, I'd always wanted to be published in Brevity too. I'd been rejected by Brevity before.
Yeah, so me really too. Excited.
I was really excited. I sent this initially to be considered for the craft essays, and the editor wrote me back, Julia, she was really sweet, wrote me back and said, this isn't right for craft essays, but I think it'd be great on the blog, send it to Dinty Moore with a photo and a bio. And so I sent it to him and I didn't hear back, and then I heard back from him the morning that it was published. So I really didn't know that it was going to be published until it was.
It looked at, and looking back at it this morning, it's got a lot of play, a lot of comments too. Like a lot of people, yeah. I think it had like 36 comments, which I think is kind of a lot. A lot of people, they, because it seesaws between, yeah, do this, but not, then this, and it basically, it's so people are like picking, they're seeing themselves in some part of those clauses, and they're like, thank you for saying this. And
I guess it resonated. Yeah. Didn't you send me an analytics screenshot at the end of the week after, or maybe it was the next day after it ran, and you know, it was this graph, and he said, see that big blue line on the end? That's you. You've gotten 3,000 hits in 2 days or something. So he's like, I knew it was good, but I guess you really hit a nerve.
And now you're on the hashtag CNF podcast.
I know. Look at me now.
But it's
funny to me how many people also didn't get it and took it literally as real writing advice. I've had a couple, there are a couple comments on there, and I've seen on Facebook some people were like, oh, what? How dare you tell people not to go to grad school? They'll lose their voice. And I'm like, it was satire.
Yeah, it's ultimately what it really is it's a permission slip for people. It's like, just remove all the worry. Like, just find yourself in here and take the leap. And the last clause of our independent clause or dependent, whatever you call it, I feel grammar, but I can't sometimes point to things. But it's just at the very end, it's just right. And that's basically, that's what it is. That's what it boils down to is, it's like the 16-year-old Shauna who just started the zine. You just wrote. And that's what this piece is. It's giving those people permission to dance with that fear and to just put something down, because you can't be a writer unless at least you're willing to write bad stuff. You have to write the bad stuff until, and then it will hopefully become good over time, but you gotta at least be willing to put out bad stuff first.
Yeah, thank you. I hope so. Yeah, just write. I guess that's the only true line in the whole piece.
Right. What is some, I mean, I guess you could read this and deduce what bad advice you hear or have been told, but what might be some of the most sort of frequent bad advice you hear, if you feel comfortable diagnosing certain advices particularly harmful?
Well, some people advise showing your memoir drafts to your family before publishing, and I don't think that's a good idea. I didn't, but I was also very naive at the time about the whole process. But I just don't think it's a good idea to show your family your early work, period, whether it's a memoir or a short story or whatever, unless you come from this huge literary family and maybe they'll have some good advice. But I find that just becomes an excuse to not write. Yeah, I could never show so-and-so this, you know, or so-and-so will never approve this. Yeah. And, you know, that's just, if you want to keep yourself from writing, then keep coming up with those excuses. But maybe
there are just untold excuses like that. And that's usually just fear of, of just, you know, of, you know, you have this idea in your head, and then there's a fear that you can't translate what's in your head down into your computer or into a notebook. So it's, yeah, it's like what you're saying, like you're just putting a, it's easy to say no if you put that roadblock in front of you.
Yeah. And then maybe not so much prescribed advice, but the also I think the cliches are dangerous. You know, this idea of the drunken writer, or you have to have a, you know, you have to be high to really tap into some inner voice, you know, like these societal cliches, I think are unfortunate because you don't, right. You know, it's just not true. You don't necessarily need an MFA, and you don't need to be a drunk to be a good writer. I mean, there's millions of examples of people who've done it their own way. So
when you're in the throes of an essay or a feature article or column, whatever it may be, what tends to be your morning routine, or how you start warming up the muscles? If you are in fact a morning person, but like, what is your, what would you say your routine is as you start to get going?
Yeah. I'm totally an early bird. I never sleep past 5:30 or 6 for some reason. I think it's just genetic. and I like to get my body moving. I live in LA. I'll go to a yoga class or take a long walk or take a bike ride. And something about getting the blood moving, I think, gets the blood moving through my brain. To get some caffeine, some tea. I don't drink coffee, but get some nice black tea going, and then hit the computer as soon as I'm done exercising. And that's where I can get lost in time, and that's where the magic happens. I can really just focus and immerse myself in words and forget about other things. I mean, there are other things, deadlines and things pulling me, but I like having a deadline that pushes me as well. I mean, yeah. I guess coming from a journalism background, there's nothing like a deadline to get my ass moving.
Yeah. Yeah. And what are you still learning and discovering about writing and reading?
That there's always more to learn. God, I mean, I haven't read most of the classics. I don't have enough reading time in my audiobooks are a miracle. My eyes are so tired at the end of the day from, you know, teaching online classes or reading student papers or answering emails that I love now to just plug in and close my eyes and put my earbuds in and listen to a book too. That's just another way to get lost in story without using my eyes. It's a little bit different absorption process, I guess, but I love that as a relaxation tool.
Yeah, it's a way of reading without reading. It's really, it's nice like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. There's just so many more books to be read. And so much time.
Fantastic. Well, I think on that note, Shauna, you know, I'll let you get out of here. This was really wonderful and fun to speak to you about your approach.
Cool. Thanks, Brandon.
Well, you're welcome. And take care, and we'll be in touch.
Big ups. Big thanks to Shauna for taking the time to speak with little old me. Hey. If you got something out of this podcast, subscribe on the Apple Podcast app or Google Play Music. Leave a review. Share this with a buddy. Thanks again. Let the riff take you out.